Okay, we are in Revelation 17 tonight. We're looking at two visions in chapter 17, and that continues into chapter 18. So we've just finished, we talked about this last time, the bowls, the final bowls being poured out at the end of the 70th week, if it be at the end of the 70th week or into that 30-day period. You know, we talked about both of those. But now the result of those bowls being poured out is going to be the destruction of the kingdom of the Antichrist. It's going to be the destruction of the Antichrist. It's going to be setting up the stage for the return of the Lord and the coming of his kingdom. And so we go into this now behind the scenes in chapter 17 and 18. It's going to become a vision, but we're going to be seeing what's going on behind the scenes, the purpose, the identification of certain players, and then their final judgment. So I've handed out just a few notes just to kind of refer to a few things, not great notes or anything, but a few things I'll refer to. Most of it's going to be easy to follow without those notes, but they're there. Chapter 17, verse 1 begins, "One of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and said to me, 'Come, I will show you the punishment of the great prostitute who sits on many waters.'" Now, this one of the seven angels is one of the seven angels that had come out of the temple with the bowls and had poured out the bowls of wrath on the kingdom of the beast and on the earth. Now, after those bowls are poured out, one of those seven comes and says, "I'm going to show you the punishment of the great prostitute." This introduces a player, not necessarily a new, but it's going to be behind the scenes so we can see what's going on with this prostitute. Now, I just got written here, it's a woman, you know, it's identified as a prostitute. We may be able to compare it to the bride that's going to be coming in chapter 19, 20, 21. And it's interesting as we identify this, and again, I'll be teaching, you're still thinking, the bride that is coming, that we're going to see coming down, is going to be identified as the New Jerusalem that is coming down. Now, when we want to talk about the bride as the church, you can consider that. The church would then be the New Jerusalem coming down. But we've got the bride that's coming, the bride of Christ, which would be identified as a church. It's also identified very clearly as New Jerusalem. It is a city that is coming down. Somehow they may be connected that New Jerusalem is the home of the church, the bride of Christ. It's his new city where he will be living and dwelling. So that would be in comparison to this woman who, interestingly, and this you know, there's different times we talk about this, is this woman is going to be seen riding the beast. And I think it's going to be simple as we read through this, but sometimes I have a tendency to want to say this woman would be the false religion. It would be the false church. The beast could be the nations, and the false church sides with the nations or the ways of the world. But if we allow this to speak as we see here, this beast has already been identified, and I think I'll be able to confirm that, as the Antichrist or the first beast that came up out of the sea. The woman is going to be very clearly identified here, just like the bride of Christ, the woman that comes down, is the new city Jerusalem or the new Jerusalem. This woman is a city. It's going to be Babylon. Now, when we talk about Babylon, we know we've got Babylon in the Old Testament, Nebuchadnezzar city. In the modern time, or if we say in the contemporary time as John's writing, the Babylon would be Rome. That would be, if it's figurative, it'd be talking about Rome. So when we start talking about a city, this woman, is it Babylon the Great, the ancient city that's going to be restored in the future? Could be. But in the time that is being written, Babylon is really nothing. The power base is Rome, the city of Rome. And so that would be a temptation to think this woman is talking about the city of Rome in John's day. But he's, again, now you've got to decide, what is John? Is John addressing? Sure, he's addressing Christians at his time that he's writing. It's addressed to the seven churches of Asia Minor. But as he looks into the future, is he actually talking about Rome, the city that was there in the first century? I'm going to say this woman represents the city which was in Nebuchadnezzar's day, the city of Babylon. It's Rome, definitely, in John's day, but it seems to be the center of the power base. We could go back and look at Nahum, and many of the things that are said about this city here, or this woman, were referred to in Nineveh, when Nineveh fell in Nahum. So in a sense, Nineveh was doing the same thing this woman done, talking about the wine of her intoxicating, the adulteries, making other nations drink her intoxicating wine. That's Nineveh in 700 B.C. But it's also Babylon in 600 B.C. But it's Rome in the first century. Nineveh's gone. Ancient Babylon's gone. Ancient Rome, in that sense, is gone. This woman is going to be this new city that is yet to come. Now, could it be revised Babylon? It certainly could. Could it be Rome? Could it involve somehow the Vatican with Rome? I suppose you could tie that together. Is it New York City, you know, in the Western world? Is that the new Babylon? Or is it you know, something like that? I don't know if we could, I don't think we can identify this city on the map today any more than we can identify the Antichrist if he's alive today, because this city has probably moved about. It captures the essence of, okay, we've already talked about this on Tuesday nights, that when man left Eden and they went out, the first thing they began to do in rebellion towards God was build cities and gather themselves together to conquer their own domain in their own way. We see the descendants of Cain doing this. We see the Tower of Babel being built and God dispersing the people. We always see cities rise up, and it's almost as if God's got his plan, the divine view, but then mankind rejects that, and in his own glory, man's glory without Christ, man's fulfillment is going to be in Christ. Man was created by Christ, will find fulfillment in the Creator, in Christ. But man, when he rejects Christ, rejects the ways of God, still has this human glory. Still has he's still made in the image of God. So mankind can go out and create, can develop, can have trade and commerce, and have universities, and develop nature and the things of science and the creation in rebellion towards God, or more like in godlessness, meaning not necessarily what we would say sinful behavior. They may be trying to do good things, but they're going to be doing it without God. We do not want to unite with Christ. We're going to unite as man and the greatness of man. Classic example in modern philosophy is secular humanism. There is no God. The hope of humanity rests with man himself. Mankind has to save mankind. That would be a classic case of Babylon, or this woman who is now uniting all of humanity with the intoxicating wines. So that's kind of what we're looking at right here, is this woman. And notice, this woman is called a prostitute. In the Old Testament, when Israel went astray, Israel was called an adulteress. She went into adultery. She, or if the church goes away, the faithless wife. There is, in that sense, a union, a religious connection, where you're associated with Yahweh or associated with Christ, and you, in a sense, as a wayward wife, go away. Maybe you like Hosea writes, they played the harlot, but they were actually a wife that was living the life of a prostitute. This woman is not called an adulteress. It's a flat-out prostitute. I mean, it's just flat-out, it has no interest in a relationship. It is living in prostitution, doing things for their own benefit. Now, with that being said, we're going to see this woman is going to be said, first of all, it says, is on many waters. Again, I'm going to throw out interpretations. You always have to be careful of interpretations, and they should be, I mean, obviously it has to be interpreted, but there should be some, that should not just be my ideas popping into my head. Ah, this might make sense, or this is what I want to mean. It would appear in Scripture the many waters would represent the nations. when you see the beast coming out of the water. It would be a beast coming out of the Gentile nations. When you see in Daniel's prophecy, the waters being stirred up, that then the beast started coming out of the nations, if it be out of Babylon or out of Persia or out of Greece or out of Italy, Rome. And so the waters, I think, we can see represent the nations. Now, the woman is on the waters, but the next thing we're going to see is the woman is riding the beast. Now, this beast, I think we can see, is already been identified as the Antichrist, or the beast out of the sea. So this is a city. Now, again, we're going to read the text, and you'll be able to say, that makes sense, or that doesn't make sense. And if it does make sense, you can raise your hand or interrupt me and say, wait, that doesn't make sense. But I think we can present clearly as we go through this, this is a city, a key functioning city in charge of a lot of commerce, a lot of people, and it is in rebellion towards God. Not necessarily in the sense that they exist to rebel against God, although Satan is going to be the power behind it, and that would be his power. They're just existing in the glory of man, absent of Christ, and Christ, any presence of Christ in that city, would call them back to a relationship to correct their worldview, and they want nothing to do with it because they're prospering, they're advancing, they're having their own cause, their own way. Obviously, it's going to lead to sin, it's going to lead to wickedness, but sometimes it's the glory of man. They're going to be advancing the cause. There's going to be great luxuries and great goods. There's probably going to be advances in science and medicine. It's going to be a great thing as man in his glory develops without Christ. So this is that would be the city. The city is going to be seen riding the beast, which now is the Antichrist, or the king, the leader, the one who is trying to take over the world. This would then be his city. And he is with this woman, is riding the beast. He's controlling this city at this time of his reign. And this beast would come in line with other beasts that you saw come up out of the sea in Daniel's, if it be Nebuchadnezzar or Cyrus or Alexander or the Caesars coming. This would be an individual who's ruling this city, and they are on the many waters, or they are controlling the nations. Just like Nineveh, we went through Nahum and other Old Testament prophecies, or the minor prophets, was seen as causing the nations to submit to Nineveh because of the advantage, the sheer advantage of Nineveh. They would willingly cooperate because they could have trade. They themselves would be able to have trade in the city of Nineveh from other nations. They'd bring their goods. Or Nineveh would give them trade and put them into their economic plan. When Nineveh fell, when Babylon invaded, Babylon did the same thing. They would lure the other nations. You need to cooperate with us because we have many advantages. You can sell your goods with us. We can sell our goods to you. We control the commerce. And you could go from a backwoods, you know, nation or backwoods city and hook up with Nineveh or hook up with Babylon, and you could have a front row seat in the world's economy. The same thing with Rome. Many nations just submitted to Rome because if we could get in line with Rome, one, they won't destroy us, plus they'll use us as a trade center and everyone gets rich. You can see this going on in the world today. Who has... Now, this will answer political questions. It's like, why are our politicians making these decisions? Well, if they were, for example, if they have the mind of Christ, if they're looking at the world from a Christian worldview, they would maybe behave in a certain way. But if they dismiss Christ, if they dismiss Christianity as legend, as foolishness, if they are just merely secular humanists, they're looking, what is the best way for us to gain glory? Now, not necessarily individual political glory, but what would be the best for our nation? It would be to sell out our traditional ways and join with this up-and-coming Nineveh, Babylon, Rome, whatever they think is up-and-coming. And behind, you know, we're just mere middle-class people. So, I mean, we read the news. We've got ideas. Our ideas are conspiracy theories or whatever. But it's like there's someone somewhere in our government that knows what's happening. I mean, they're looking at it. Now, a lot of times they look incompetent. a lot of times because they're trying to, you know, not let you see the truth because they're doing something. Now, I'm not talking about any individual political party. That's just the way of politics. Someone sees what's coming, and they're doing this very thing. They're drinking the wine of this prostitute, of this woman. They're drinking the intoxicating wine because look how rich we can get. Look how much glory we can have, how advanced we will become. If we hold our ground right here and we stay independent, we will not be able to hook up with Nineveh or hook up with Babylon or hook up with Rome or hook up with, fill in the blank, what are we trying to hook up with? And even vice versa. Nations are going to try to come to America, to New York. And it's like, if we could just get trade with the United States, their economy would change. And that's just the way it's worked since the first city was built before the Tower of Babel, and it's the way it's working. So with that in mind, that's what we're looking at here. We're looking at that scenario. So here we go. Chapter 17, verse 1. One of the seven angels who had poured out this one of the bowls came and said to me, "Come, I will show you the punishment of the great prostitute." Now, this begins with the idea that this is now, everything's falling. This is the end of Revelation. This is the end of the 70th week. We're into that 30-day period, either after the 70th week, in something, wherever you want to place this. But this is what's going on behind the scenes. This woman, just like Nineveh, the book of Nahum was about the punishment of Nineveh. There was the writings about Jeremiah, Isaiah, Ezekiel all talked about the punishment of Babylon the Great, of Nebuchadnezzar's city. Because you can push it so far, but as we see in the minor prophets, we just got done with Habakkuk, or we're in the middle of Habakkuk on Tuesday nights, you can cycle through and you can have this power, but the way you're behaving, the decisions you're making are not in line with reality, and there is going to be a fallout, and someone else is going to conquer you. Nineveh can rise up, but the way you're behaving, you're going to collapse, and someone else is going to take your place. And in their arrogance, they're going to take over, but in their arrogance, they're going to make mistakes, and they're going to fall, and so it continues. And now, of course, this woman is, you know, in that 70th week, is undefeatable, and the beast is unbeatable. But the way they're living, in their arrogance, the hubris, they're not going to be able to endure. And here it comes. "Come, I'll show you the punishment of the great prostitute who sits on many waters." And I think that they're based on many waters, many nations, many peoples are involved. "With her, the kings of the earth committed adultery." Instead of choosing the way of God or the following the Christ, they chose to follow Nineveh, Babylon, Rome, this woman, whoever this woman is, whatever the city is. "And the inhabitants of the earth were intoxicated with the wine of her adulteries." Now, we're using sexual terms here, but this wine is nothing more than her being able to offer you the advantage of being in commerce with her, of being in culture with her, being in sync, having the same values as her, and you will reach the glory of man in this age. And so the kings, you can just imagine the nations coming together today and sitting around and talking. And this has to be happening, not in this verse, not this, you know, the actual prophecy, but this was happening in the Old Testament, in the New Testament. It's been happening throughout history. When they get together at the United Nations, or they're going to have this, you know, the Green New Deal meeting somewhere where they're all going to fly their planes and talk about saving the culture, saving the planet, saving the climate, they're trying to find what's the next power move? Where's the money at? Where's the influence at? And they may be calling it climate change, maybe trying to save the planet, but the reason they're all flying jets over there is this the next move the woman is going to make? Now, the woman, whoever this woman is at our time in history, is they want to be part of it because that's where the kings are going to help mankind reach their glory. And all the inhabitants of the earth are going to be like, yes, when you start seeing gas prices come down and the luxury things start coming into your house, and then you find out, yeah, but we've sold out too. It's like, I don't know if it really matters. Look at the price of gas. Look at the available groceries. Look at the lifestyle we're living. And it's like, we're making bad decisions. Yeah, but the advantage, and that's why I think we're talking here, with the kings of the earth committed adultery, and the inhabitants of the earth were intoxicated with the wine of her adulteries. Now, those adulteries, you could try to fill that in with false religion and say it's Christianity gone astray. You could say that, but I think it's more general and it's broader than that. It's just mankind seeking man's glory and the advancement of the human race without Christ. And again, that could include, listen, the church is going to go, the false church is going to follow this, but I don't think we need to limit it to just some branch of Christianity. Okay, that's who this woman is. She's influencing all the inhabitants of the earth. And again, they're intoxicated with the wine, meaning you can't come up and say, "Do you see what you're doing?" As if you're talking to a drunk person. You're drunk. Do you understand what you're doing? It's like, no, and they can't reason. And so when you get intoxicated with it, and this could happen to any one of us. This is not like them versus us. We are members of this human race. We are members of the earth. And until you identify this and you can try to avoid it, you could just well be caught up in it and not even know you're drunk on the glory of man. And when Christ calls you, you can't even hear it. You don't even believe Christ exists. You don't even believe God has a plan. You're so drunk on the glory of man right here. And the inhabitants of the earth were intoxicated with the wine of her adulteries. Then the angel carried me away in the spirit into a desert. There I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast that was covered with blasphemous names. Now this is interesting because he's going into the wilderness. Many times in the Bible, when you go to the wilderness, that's where you see behind the scenes. When you're looking at this woman, you can be intoxicated. It's like you can't see clearly. But when you take it, okay, come, John, we're going to go into the desert. We're going to go into the wilderness. We're going to go away from all of this. And now we're going to show you behind the scenes what this actually looks like. And this is where you kind of get a clear picture of what's really going on. Because over here, everyone's like, this is great. This is great. Prices are down. Products are up. Life is good. Come with me to the wilderness and let's look at this from a different angle. I mean, that could be the purpose of what's going on here. I saw a woman on a scarlet beast. Now, scarlet was the same color as the red dragon, and it's a beast, that was covered with blasphemous names. Now, that lines up with the little horn of Daniel, which was the Antichrist. Boastful things, blasphemous names. That matches the first beast coming out of the sea that we saw in chapter 13. This, I think, is the Antichrist. Now, again, I'm going to say that. I've got it written here. That's the end. This is not a new beast. This beast has been playing throughout the last couple chapters. So this is the city that is riding this beast who's over the waters. And this is the Antichrist. A scarlet beast that was covered with blasphemous names and had 7 heads and 10 horns. 7 heads. I want you to see this. 7 heads and 10 horns. Now this, again, I don't want to oversimplify this, but I do want to make this simple. I mean, it's not like we've got to be rocket scientists to figure this out, I don't think. And that means I can maybe oversimplify it and maybe miss something. On your notes, I wrote this down so I would have a quick way of looking at it. Look, right about in the middle, right where it says woman, beast, many waters, right above that, the beast the woman rides has 7 heads and 10 horns in chapter 17, verse 3. 7 heads and 10 horns. If you go back to chapter 12, verse 3, where you saw the woman that was taken into the wilderness, that was Israel, that was protected, the red dragon in chapter 12, verse 3, had 7 heads and 10 horns, and that was Satan. And if you go, that's chapter 12. If you go to chapter 13, the beast, chapter 13, verse 1, the beast that came out of the sea, the Antichrist, had 7 heads and 10 horns. So you've got Satan, you've got the Antichrist, and you've got this beast right here with 7 heads and 10 horns. It's right there in the text. And this can all go back to Daniel and be connected there. And we already know Satan is going to give the first beast his power, his authority. And the Antichrist, which is this beast, which is the beast, the first beast in chapter 13, is going to rule for Satan on the earth, and Satan's going to give him power. In fact, he's going to give him the second beast, the false prophet, to help confirm signs and wonders to convince the nations to follow the Antichrist. So it's not surprising that Satan, the red dragon, the Antichrist, the first beast of chapter 13, and now this beast all have seven heads and ten horns. Okay, I mean, that makes it, you know, it's all in sync. But now, what are the seven heads? And this could become, again, confusing. I've got this written down. The seven heads or seven mountains are going to come up later also. You don't have to accept this, but there's other ways of looking at it. These seven heads, Nebuchadnezzar, for example, when he sees that vision of the statue, the head of gold, Daniel says, with his interpretation given him by the Lord, he says, "You are that head of gold." Nebuchadnezzar was the head of the Babylonian Empire. And it goes back and forth. And I think there's been other scholars write about this. I don't say others as if I'm a scholar, but I've read I thought this, and I've read it in other commentaries, that when it talks about the Babylonian kingdom, you're talking about Babylon, for example, the Old Testament Babylon from the time 612, when they had the Battle of Carchemish up and through, you know, I'm saying 612, 605, up until it falls to Persia. That was Babylon, the Babylon Empire. But it is also referred to as Nebuchadnezzar. So it refers to the king and the kingdom, even though the king that began the kingdom dies and is inherited by his son and his grandson, it's Nebuchadnezzar. So Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonian kingdom, depending on the vision, they're the same thing. Same thing, here comes Cyrus, but when Cyrus comes, he gives way to his son and his grandson, but Persia and Cyrus are the same, although Cyrus is going to die and someone is going to take his place. And same thing, Alexander the Great is going to come. Greece, but then that gives way to the four generals. And so when we talk about the seven heads, we're talking about, yes, and maybe an individual man, but that man is the king of an empire that will then rule for a while. And the kingdoms that we've got in the Old Testament would begin, if you were willing to accept it clearly, number three, Babylon, Persia, Greece, Rome, that's right out of Daniel. That's the four beasts. That's the statue. But again, remember, that was given to Nebuchadnezzar and Daniel in vision form in 603 BC in the midst or at the beginning of the Babylonian Empire. So it talks about four beasts and then a final beast that is going to come. Obviously, they're not going to talk about Assyria and Egypt because they've already happened. But when we talk about seven mountains, you can talk about the power base being in Egypt. Egypt's power base clearly gave way to Assyria. And now we're right in the text of Scripture. Assyria, Nahum, falls to Babylon. Now you're in the book of Daniel, Jeremiah, Ezekiel. Babylon falls to Persia. Persia falls to Greece. Greece falls to Rome, just like the prophecies say. And that's your first and second, Egypt and Assyria, Babylon, Persia, Greece, Rome. That's 1 through 6. And then there's going to be a final kingdom, just like you saw in Daniel's prophecy, the head of gold, the chest of silver, the waist of bronze, the legs of iron. That's Babylon, Persia, Greece, legs of iron, Rome. And then a final form of the kingdom, the feet mixed with iron and clay mixed together. That's the final kingdom where the rock that was not cut out by human hands strikes the final form of the kingdoms, which is the feet of iron and clay, and it crumbles and it's all just blown away. And the rock that struck the statue, the rock that was not cut out by human hands, meaning it's a divine origin, becomes a very huge mountain kingdom and covers the entire earth, and it will reign forever and ever. And so from there, when it says seven heads, I think you're talking about Egypt, the kingdom, the empire, gave way to Assyria, gave way to Babylon, gave way to Persia, gave way to Greece, gave way to Rome, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And the seventh one is the one we're talking about. This beast would be the Nebuchadnezzar of this kingdom, this age right here. Now, remember in the book of Daniel, there was 10 horns. There was 10 horns, and then a little horn grew up. And of those 10 horns, talking about the final days of history, there's 10 horns, which are kings. Sometimes it says kings, sometimes horns. 10 powers. Think 10 kings over 10 nations. And these 10 are in some kind of unified form, some kind of unified function. And then this little horn, which is clearly the Antichrist, grows up and takes out 3 of the 10. So now he controls 10, 9, and 8, those kingdoms. Those kings have been removed and have been subjected to this little horn. And then the other 7 horns just submit to the little horn in the book of Daniel. In other words, they've got their 10 kingdoms and they're all unified. This little horn rises up and doesn't just take out 3 and they're cheering him on. They apparently realize he's just going to take out 1, 2, a little Hitler comes and just starts taking out kingdoms, and the other 7 go, oh, we'll give it to you. And they all are given. In fact, Revelation says there's going to be 10 kings, and they are given power for a short time, for an hour, and their purpose is to give their power to the beast. So these 10 horns are the 10 contemporary kings or nations of this time period who just were given power by God, so that when they see the Antichrist coming, they're just going to go, here, you take ours. And Daniel says he takes out the first 3 before the last 7 give it to him. So the 7 heads are the 7 kingdoms that have been ruled by Satan, who's been doing the same thing, because they are kingdoms that are godless kingdoms. Egypt, Assyria, Babylon. That doesn't mean they're totally sinful and wicked. It means they're godless. That means they're not building their society in the fear of God for Christ. They're separating from Christ and pursuing the glory of man. And Egypt did a great job of bringing glory to man and developing his potential. The Assyrians, we've seen the monuments. They were a great people. They ruled. They developed writing. We've got cuneiform tablets that were from the Assyrians. And you know, I mean, they're the great people. These were the great societies of the past. They were godless. They were Christless, but they took man's glory. Babylon, nothing's greater than Babylon. Persia, Greece. I mean, do we need to say anything about Greece? Rome, the people still wonder at the glory of Rome. These were mighty empires. They were Satan's base of operation. They were godless. Doesn't mean they were like totally corrupt, although it does mean they're totally corrupt in the sense that they're godless. But they did take man's glory and advance the cause of civilization. Civilizations were better in a sense because of it, because Rome made great roads. Greece made great government. The Persians, they had a road system. You could travel across the Persian Empire in a matter of days. I mean, we could go on and talk about all the great things they did, include develop writing and the pyramids and all these things. But it was without Christ. Those are the 7 heads, and now the 7th one has now come in the form of the beast. And the 10 are going to be the contemporary kingdoms that he absorbs. He's got his own kingdom, but he takes in 10, and they're given power for one purpose of giving their power at this time in history to the beast so he can function as the last and final form of Satan's kingdoms that are ruling the earth. And notice, each of these oppressed Israel. Egypt, Assyria destroyed northern Israel. Egypt kept them slaves. Assyria destroyed northern Israel. Babylon destroyed Judah and Jerusalem. Persia ruled them but set them free. Greece going to end up coming with the Seleucid Empire. You got the whole Maccabean revolt. And then, of course, Rome destroys the temple in 70 AD. So every one of these empires oppressed the people of God, oppressed Israel. That's historical. You say, I disagree with your interpretation of the 7 heads. You can. But what I just said about these kingdoms, that's absolutely historical. Okay. So anyway, there's seven heads and seven, let me read it again, 17, okay. The beast, the scarlet beast that the woman, this city is riding on, was covered with blasphemous names and had seven heads, historical empires, and ten horns. I do want to pause right here and say, remember Satan approaching Jesus with the three temptations. And one of the temptations was, bow down and worship me, and I will give you the kingdoms of the world. And he says, Satan says, because they were given to me, and I can give them to whoever I want. He could give them to Pharaoh or Nebuchadnezzar or Cyrus. Now again, he's working in, I don't want to say in league with the Lord, but he's working under the permission, because God also calls Nebuchadnezzar, and even Daniel says, the Lord has given these things to your power, but Satan is using them. If you understand, there's two powers that are working. God's in ultimate control. But nonetheless, Jesus was given an opportunity. Instead of going to the cross, why don't we just, you want to set up a kingdom? Why don't you set your kingdom up in my kingdom, and you can be the ruler of the world? And Jesus said, no, I'll take the cross first and the crown later and get rid of you totally. I mean, that's not exactly what he says, but that's what he did. The woman was dressed in purple and scarlet and was glittering with gold, precious stones, and pearls. Now you can go through and make a, try to make connections out of that. Nonetheless, it's all luxurious. The purple was the Muroc snail, very expensive. That's why purple is still today a color of royalty, because it was so expensive. They had to crush these snails in Phoenicia, you know the story, to get the purple dye. What's her name in the book of Acts was a trader in purple dye, and Lydia went up to where was she at? I want to say Thyatira. That's not, was that where she was? That wasn't where she was. Anyway, I'm pulling off the top of my head. Anyway, nonetheless, she was a very wealthy, because she's her products were very elaborate. Now you notice right here, you've got Christians dealing with marketing here, even in the book of Acts. So again, it doesn't mean you have to live on the side of a hill somewhere and dig your own potatoes. Although sometimes, Tony and I have been talking about, that's kind of where we'd like to go. But nonetheless, dressed in purple, scarlet, glittering gold, precious stones, and pearls. Now, that can be compared to the woman that's coming, the New Jerusalem, who's going to be dressed in fine linen, or the woman of chapter 12 who was hidden from the dragon, which would be Israel. So this woman is compared on the beginning of the woman that was hidden in the wilderness, protected by God, and the woman who's coming when Jesus Christ returns. These are, you know, those would be, this is just a contrast. She held a golden cup in her hand. Okay, this woman, and you know what this golden cup is, holds a golden cup in her hand filled with abominable things and the filth of her adulteries. In other words, all the luxury things, the glory, basically say the glory of man that she has, and it's in a cup, and she's passing it around to all these nations. This is exactly what is said by the prophets about Nineveh, what Nineveh was doing, and what Babylon was doing, was passing around the goblet. Here, look what I can offer you, and it's intoxicating, and they take it. Now, this title was written on her forehead. Roman writers from this time period write that the prostitutes in Rome would wear like a headdress, a headpiece, like a band on their head with their name on the front of the band, so you'd know what the prostitute's name was. And so when it says this is written on her forehead, I don't think you need to think of a tattoo in this that sense, but think about someone that's dressed in purple and scarlet, you know, purple and red clothes with glittering gold, got this real nice headpiece, and then on the front of her forehead is her name written right there for you to see who she is. Then it says, written on her forehead. Now that word, it says mystery. In my NIV Bible, it's written on her forehead, mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of prostitutes and of the abominations of the earth. I would say, and scholars say this, that word mystery is an identifier that maybe should be in the sentence. Written on her forehead is mystery. Now again, meaning it's not written mystery on her forehead, but this is the mystery. What's the mystery? The mystery is written right on her forehead. It's like, who is this woman? John is saying this is the mystery. I'm going to reveal to you the mystery. This woman is, and it's very no debate at this point, Babylon the Great. It is the city. Now, is it Babylon of Nebuchadnezzar's day? I think we've talked about that. You could try to force that, but we've got a moving target here. It's in Egypt. It's in Assyria. It's Nineveh. It's Babylon. It's Rome. It's, you know, wherever it is today and wherever it's going to be in this day, it's the same city. It's where the power base of Satan is manifesting. But it's Babylon the Great, and it is the mother of prostitutes. All prostitutes in this sense are those who become godless, those who are going to go off and perform without God, without Christ, and in their own fashion to get their own desires to, for the glory of God. This Babylon the Great is the mother of all prostitutes. Everyone who goes this direction is coming from, this is the mystery. First, it is the city of Babylon. The second part of the mystery is, this is the thinking that leads to all the prostitutes around the world. And we're talking not about sexual prostitutes, but we're talking about those who go out of God's plan and try to pursue God, man's glory without the Christ. The mother of prostitutes and the abominations of the earth, and their pursuit of man's glory without Christ leads to all the abominations of the earth, all the hideous things man can do in pursuit of his own glory, his own pleasure, his own luxury, his own advancement, his own ambitions. I mean, not every one of these things could be labeled evil. Well, it could be labeled evil. It would be labeled sinful. I mean, you've got ambition. I want to build a city. I want to build a house. I want to build a business. Well, without Christ, it's going to become an abomination because you're doing it for your own glory without Christ. I mean, there's a clear line. It's either for God or it's without God. So she's the mother. This city is the mother of all prostitutes, all who live this way, and of all the abominations that man creates in the pursuit of his own glory without God. Now, man can pursue his own. That's what the book of Hebrews is talking about. Man can pursue his own glory. Man was created by God for a purpose, and man doesn't even understand the fullness of his potential. But we see Christ who's going to lead man into his full potential. I mean, we're not even there yet. We'll never see it on this side of history. Okay, goes on. I saw that the woman, watch this, if you're going to pursue the glory of man without Christ, who are you going to continually have to come against? Right here. I saw that the woman was drunk with the blood of the saints, the blood of those who bore testimony to Jesus, the blood of those who bore testimony to the Christ. You bring Christ into this world of this woman who's trying to pursue the glory of man without Christ, you're going to be slaughtered. They do not need that. Now, that this is the way history has gone. We go back, we look at those seven nations, or empires, every one of them, except you could say Persia possibly, crushed the people of God, Israel. Rome persecuted the Christians throughout history. It is still that way today. You go to the world, you go to this woman, you go to secular humanism and say, we want to bring in Christ. We want to talk about God. We want to talk about the Creator. They're right now trying to, and they all have been, legally persecute the advancement of Christianity in universities, in schools, in public. We still have churches, but just education itself has wiped out a lot of churches because they're too modernized, they're too progressive, that they're giving it up without fighting. The day is coming when the barriers are broken down where there will be a direct assault on Christianity in our culture. It will be flat out illegal, criminal. You need to be eliminated. It's like, how do you, that will never happen. I mean, it's happened. The fact that it's not happening is what is unique. Now, it's hard for us because we live in this society, but the fact that Christianity is not oppressed here, I mean, totally is what is unique in history. Because you go back through history, starting with Jesus, the apostles, every one of the apostles except John died a martyr. And John was definitely persecuted. He writes this book in isolation on the Isle of Patmos, where he was exiled. Anyway, this woman, she's drunk, again, meaning she's not even able to think. She's so bent on crushing Christ and his testimony out of human history that she's drunk with this concept, making illogical decisions. She's going to be making illogical decisions. It's going to lead to her downfall because she's bent on destroying the ideology of Christianity. When I say Christianity, I mean of the Christ, not a particular denomination. When I saw her, I was greatly astonished. Then the angel said to me, "Why are you astonished? I will explain to you the mystery of the woman and of the beast she rides, which has the seven heads and the ten horns." See, the beast she's riding has the seven heads and the ten horns. She's just a city that's on top of the empires at this point in history. John, it's not that confusing. Just like Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar, Babylon was writing the Babylonian Empire. Nineveh was writing the Assyrian Empire. This woman, this city, is writing the mountain right here. This is the mountain that we're writing. I saw her greatly astonished. I'll explain to you. He says, verse 8, "The beast which you saw," okay, the beast right here that she's riding, "which you saw once was, now is not, and will come up out of the abyss and go to his destruction." So there it is. They once were here. They were here. Were sent to the abyss for a time. So they are not. They will come up out of the abyss. And then when they come that last time to manifest at this point in history, when it happens, they will then go to their total destruction. So that gives you the impression of why when Jesus comes back, he captures the beast and throws it into the lake of fire alive. Because that power has been moving through the earth. It's been removed by John's day. It was in power, but by John's day, it had been removed and sent into the abyss, waiting for this day. It will be released at this day, whenever it happens, to have this moment as the Antichrist, the power base of the Antichrist, and will rule. And then it's going to say, in other words, don't be astonished. It was already here. It was removed. It's going to be brought back, and then it's going to be removed. "I will explain to you the mystery of the woman and of the beast she rides, which has the seven heads and ten horns. The beast which you saw once was, now is not, and will come up out of the abyss and go to his destruction." Now, when it says once was, now is not, it will go to its destruction, you could see, is that the power of Rome that's going to be fading away and then it will come back again? I mean, you could start trying to figure out what it is. Is it a power base that transferred from Rome into the Byzantine Empire, into the Ottoman Empire? Ottoman Empire has been set aside and the Ottoman Empire is going to come back and manifest this beast. I mean, those are all things we got to put together. And maybe don't even fit right here. "The inhabitants of the earth, though, whose names have not been written in the book of life from the creation of the world, will be astonished when they see the beast, because he once was, now is not, and yet will come." It's going to be one of these great, it was there in Egypt and Assyria and all the way through, and now appears to have, in Rome at this time in history, have been removed. But when they see this revised Roman Empire, which is an extension of the Greek Empire, an extension of the Persian, they see this come back into world history, the inhabitants of the earth are going to be like, we have never seen anything like this before. But it's going to be just the resurfacing of one of those mighty empires. And again, this is part of the mystery that's being revealed. And again, there's much more to be said about this, but I'm watching the clock and I want to finish this chapter. But anyway, "The inhabitants of the earth, whose names have not been written in the book of life from the creation of the world, will be astonished when they see this beast," which is this Antichrist, which is where the beast is ruling from this city over his empire, over many nations, they'll see this beast. They're not going to be forced. They're going to be amazed by this. They're going to worship. They're going to follow this beast because unbelievable. The beast is going to have the false prophet, which has the image, which is commanding everyone to receive the mark that the beast wants to give. It's like they're willing participants in this. Because again, the intoxicating wine of the city that the beast is ruling. Verse 9. Now again, everything I've said, you got to put that on hold because watch verse 9. "This calls for a mind with wisdom." Okay, meaning what you just read, I cannot sum that up just boom, as fast as I did, and be accurate. I mean, you're going to have to go back and look at that again. You're going to have to comb through it, look at it from different angles, and you're going to have some insight into what's taking place right there. I think I'm close, but I'm sure I'm missing some details on that. Now watch this next part right here, and this helps clarify some things. This verse 9, this calls for a mind with wisdom, and this can cause you to trip all over yourself. The seven heads are seven hills on which the woman sits. So the woman is sitting on a beast. Right, but that beast is Egypt, Assyria, Babylon, Persia, Greece, Rome, and then, oh, that's six. And then this final kingdom right there. This woman is sitting right here on seven hills. Now that word hills, other place in this book, is translated mountains. The writers, the same Roman writers who talked about, for example, I told you that the prostitutes having written on their forehead their name with a little decorative, you know, crown or ribbon or whatever, they wrote much about their culture. It was common to understand Rome, the city of Rome, as the city on seven hills, because there's seven major hills in Rome. So Rome is the city of seven hills. And so that, people right there stumble. Now again, maybe you want to hook on to that because we're talking, Rome is in power right here. As he's writing this, Domitian is the emperor. He's going to be assassinated and Trajan's going to come into power and release all of Domitian's political enemies. And that's why John is going to get off the island that he's on in Patmos in 96 AD. They also referred to Rome as the city of seven hills. So in contemporary writing, the seven hills, the woman sits on the seven hills, it's Rome. But this is a city sitting on seven hills, which is a city. Now you can run that route if you want to, but it doesn't fit what I'm presenting here. So if you're going to say, because he's saying, I'm going to explain this to you, this calls for a mind with wisdom, the seven heads are seven hills on which the woman sits. The seven heads, that I'm saying the seven empires, are seven mountains, which is exactly what an empire or a kingdom is, that the woman sits. This woman, if it be a city in Egypt or Nineveh or Babylon or Persepolis or Rome, whatever it is, this woman is sitting on these seven mountains. She will be sitting, this is a city sitting on one of these empires that is satanically influenced. Now that can send you down a road. Let me read this some more. They are also seven kings. Now remember what I said when you talk about Babylon is also Nebuchadnezzar. Cyrus is also Persia. Alexander is also Greece. So it's like the Caesars are also Rome. So these seven hills, these seven empires, these seven kingdoms, these seven mountains, they're also seven kings. And we could go through there. You get the Pharaoh, you're going to have Sennacherib you could have there, or Ashurbanipal, Nebuchadnezzar, you know, Osiris, Alexander, all the leaders of those empires, the original empires, they're seven men also. So there's seven empires or there's seven kings. And now watch this, please. Five have fallen. One, two, three, four, five. Egypt, Assyria, Babylon, Persia, Greece have fallen. One is Rome in 63 AD. And one is yet to come in the future. I mean, bam, we haven't even broken stride. But if you want to say, seven hills must be Rome, there are also seven kings, they must be the Caesars, and then you go, here I got the bottom of the page, okay, here you go, five have been. Now you can't count Julius Caesar, you've got to count Augustus, Tiberius, Caligula, Claudius, and Nero. Okay, one is, well if you want Nero to be the one that is, you're going to have to count Julius Caesar, Augustus, Tiberius, Caligula, Claudius, Nero is, and then you've got Galba, Otho, Vitellius, they all were quick rulers that came after after Nero committed suicide, while Vespasian was marching from the war in Jerusalem to take over the throne, left his son Titus as the general. The Vespasian, the general, comes to Rome and takes over and removes those three. Now you've got Vespasian, and then the seventh is Titus or Vespasian. But now the book of Revelation is going to be written after Nero's death, but it's supposed to be written during Nero's reign if you're preterist. Nothing's fitting there. And if you say you're going to try to make those kings make sense of 96 AD, authoring of this book, Domitian is going to be coming after Titus, and the one that's to come is Trajan, who's going to release John from the island, and your whole number system's completely, it doesn't make sense. Now, that's me disagreeing with a system. Now, if someone advances that system, they can do it, but you're going to have to cross out those three minor emperors, and you still don't have the consistency of, even if you have the book written during Nero's reign or after Nero, it just falls apart. So I do not think those seven hills are Rome. I think those seven hills are seven mountains, which are the seven kingdoms, the seven empires, that the last one is the feet of iron and clay, which is struck by the rock, not cut out by human hands, and when it strikes it, everything turns to chaff and is blown away, but that rock becomes, as Daniel says, a mountain that covers the whole earth, which is an empire that will never pass away. So again, it all just flows, I think. Again, the others can teach it different ways. Must remain for a little while. The beast who once was, now is not, is an eighth king. He belongs to the seven and is going to his destruction. That's this beast. The ten horns you saw, well, here it is. The ten horns, we already said what this is. It matches the interpretation I gave you. You saw are ten kings who have not yet received a kingdom in 96 AD, but who for 1 hour, now does that mean 60 minutes or does that mean one period of time like 7 years? But for 1 hour will receive authority as kings along with the beast. They have one purpose, and they will give their power and authority to the beast. Now, according to Daniel, the beast eliminates three of the ten, and the other seven just give it to them. So ten give them their power, three by force, three, seven, just because, okay, I see what's coming. Verse 14, they, these ten kings who gave their power to the beast, they'll make war against the Lamb, but the Lamb will overcome them. So that may be the Battle of Armageddon. They're going to join with the beast, fight against the Lamb. Again, I'm just throwing that in there. That's a battle. That may be the Battle of Armageddon. That may be Revelation chapter 20 when the Lord comes back, or chapter 19. But the Lamb will overcome them because he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and because he's the Christ. That's Psalm chapter 2. You kings of the earth, be warned. Kiss the Son, lest he be angry, because his wrath can flare up in a moment. Meaning you're rocking and rolling here during this 7 years, but understand, be warned, the Lamb, the Christ, the Messiah, the Son is coming. And if you haven't paid him homage, he will take you down. And with him will be his called, chosen, and faithful followers. That would be the resurrected saints or the saints that are on the earth, and we could talk about that. Then the angel said to me, the waters you saw, see the waters that the woman was on, but she's on the beast who's on the waters now. The waters you saw were where the prostitute sits, and she's sitting on the beast who's on the waters. See, it doesn't say specifically the beast is on the waters. It says the woman is ruling over many. This city is ruling over many waters, just like Nineveh was intoxicating the many nations and peoples. But this king, this beast, is what the woman is riding. This is the power base for this city, just like Nebuchadnezzar was the power base for Babylon. Then the angel said to me, the waters you saw where the prostitute sits are peoples, multitudes, nations, and languages. The beast and the ten horns you saw will hate the prostitute. This beast and the ten horns, the ten kings, will hate this city, will hate this prostitute. They will bring her to ruin and leave her naked. They will eat her flesh and burn her with fire, for God has put it into their hearts to accomplish his purpose by agreeing to give the beast their power to rule until God's words are fulfilled. Now, in other words, God, this is just like in Nahum, Nineveh was destroyed by Babylon. Jerusalem was going to be overrun by Babylon. This was all, God is just using Babylon to overthrow the Assyrians, and using Babylon to overthrow Judah and Jerusalem, and then he's going to use Cyrus to overthrow the Babylonians. Right here, he wants to take this woman down. He wants to take this woman and eliminate her. So he takes these 10 kings who are given power, who give their power to the beast, and it is set in their hearts God's will, God's desire to destroy this woman and burn her with fire, to just destroy her. And the beast that she's riding on, him and these 10 kings turn and destroy this city. And that is God's punishment is coming on this of Babylon through the beast himself. So it would be like Nebuchadnezzar destroying his own city, or like it says, an eighth king is coming. It'd be like Cyrus coming in and taking Babylon, or Alexander taking Persepolis and burning it to the ground. The new king that replaces this, or however this works, they are going to take this city and begin the destruction. So it's interesting. Before Jesus comes back, they're destroying the city itself. God's punishment, just like it keeps cycling through before Jesus comes back, and then he's going to capture the beast and the false prophet and throw them directly in the lake of fire. They've already done his work. I'll read that again. The beast and the 10 horns you saw will hate the prostitute. They will bring her to ruin and leave her naked. They will eat her flesh and burn her with fire, for God has put it, and again, that's not just to destroy, but probably to take it and start some new form, an eighth kingdom that they think they're going to that's not going to develop. For God has put it into their hearts to accomplish his purpose by agreeing to give the beast their power to rule until God's words are fulfilled. Verse 18, to end it here. The woman you saw is the great city that rules over the kings of the earth. She's ruling over them, and then these kings decide, let's take her down and let's form our own. Kind of like America, politicians want to deconstruct the United States because they're going to rebuild a better United States. So they will turn on the United States to destroy the United States because they've got an ideal of a new utopia they're going to make. And ultimately, that's why Isaiah is told by God, don't call conspiracy everything that these people call conspiracy. It is the Lord you are to fear. If they are actively turning and trying to destroy our system, it is by the hand of God that they're doing God's will of destroying it. They're not going to create something better. They're just going to destroy for God this system so he can move on with his plan, and they're going to have nothing. And so that's exactly what you see happening with from Assyria to Babylon, from Babylon to Persia, is them turning and destroying the system, thinking they're going to create a new system. And if God's willing, it cycles into another one. Otherwise, it just ends. And so I think you can see that taking place. Now, the next chapter is nothing different. The woman you saw is the great city that rules over the kings of the earth. So this woman is the great city, Babylon, that's ruling wherever, whatever the city is. I don't know what city it's going to be. Maybe it's a city in China. Maybe it's a city in Taiwan. Maybe it's a city in Europe. Maybe it's Rome. Maybe it's New York. I mean, I don't know. But that's where the power base is going to be. It's going to be overrun. And now here's the fall. The very next chapter continues, chapter 18. After this, I saw another angel coming down from heaven. And again, this is not one of those that had the bowls, apparently. It doesn't say it specifically. He had great authority, and the earth was illuminated by his splendor. With a mighty voice, he shouted, "Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great. She's become the home for demons." And now he's going to describe what has just taken place right here while the beast and the 10 kings turned on this city. Babylon has fallen, and then now you got a whole chapter describing this fall. And that ties in, if you remember, to that seventh bowl of the final judgments. This is just the behind the scenes of what's actually taking place when that bowl or those bowls are being poured out. So that's chapter 17 of Revelation. A lot to be said there. I will pray. If you've got a question or comment, feel free. And listen, there are corrections and insights and redirections that can be made here. This is not like there. I resolved any questions about chapter 17. That's not, no, I read through 17 and threw out some bits and pieces. And if I teach it again in a week, it would be slightly different probably. And, you know, maybe better, maybe worse. Father, we do thank you again for your truth. We thank you for your word. We ask that we may understand it, that we may make application to our own lives, that we would be the city of God, that we would be the people that you've called us to be, that we would bring Christ to the nations, that we would live a life that's in harmony with our Creator and with the Christ that you've appointed to rule the nations. Father, we do ask that we do our part at this time in history. In Jesus' name, amen. Thank you for your time.